There we go. All right. Good to see everybody. Hello. We are continuing our class on the visions of God. We are in the book of Ezekiel, and we are in chapter 4. And before we dive into chapter 4, I wanted to put us in context. So this is after Ezekiel's call. You remember the first chapter, he says he saw visions of God. He sees the living creatures, the cherubim, with the wheels within the wheels and the throne and all those kinds of things. And God tells him, I'm going to make you hard-headed and tough because you got a tough job. And I'm going to give you my word to eat. And he gives him a scroll. It's written on the inside and the outside. And in his mouth it tastes as sweet as honey, but in his belly it was bitter. And then after God gives him his commission, he goes and sits in the middle of the elders of the people for 7 days. He says he was appalled or dismayed. And God comes and says, Ezekiel, let me tell you, you're a watchman. If you don't tell the people what I've told you to tell them, you're going to be at fault. Their blood I'm going to require in your hand. They're still going to die in their sins, but their blood I'll require at your hand. And if you warn them and they ignore your warning, they're going to die in their sins, but you will have saved yourself. Right? He was encouraging Ezekiel to get up and get after the work that he had been told to do. So we are about to launch into several chapters here where Ezekiel is an object lesson, graphically portraying what's going to happen to the city of Jerusalem. And when you read commentaries on apocalyptic literature, where there's lots of figurative things and visions and various things, people always want to try to argue, you know, what's figurative and what's not, and what's a vision and what's not. Well, we're about ready to see something here that, for all that I can tell, although there are people who disagree, this is literally what God told Ezekiel to do. And we're going to talk about it. And if you wonder why I have this here with me today, you will find out in a minute. For those on the internet, I have a handful of beans and a 32-ounce bottle of, actually it's Gatorade, but it's the best I could do for liquid. So let's read, we're going to read through chapters 4 and 5, and then we're going to dive in. And you, son of man, take a brick and set it in front of you, inscribe a city on it, Jerusalem, lay siege to it, build siege works against it, erect a siege ramp against it, post soldiers outside it, and station battering rams around it. Then for your part, take an iron frying pan and set it up as an iron wall between you and the city. Set your face toward it. It is to be under siege. You are to besiege it. This is a sign for the house of Israel. Also for your part, lie on your left side and place the iniquity of the house of Israel on it. For the number of days you lie on your side, you will bear their iniquity. I have determined that the number of years of their iniquity are to be the number of days for you, 390 days. So bear the iniquity of the house of Israel. When you have completed these days, then lie down a second time, but on your right side, and bear the iniquity of the house of Judah 40 days. I have assigned 1 day for each year. You must turn your face toward the siege of Jerusalem with your arm bared and prophesy against it. Look here, I will tie you up with ropes so you cannot turn from one side to the other until you complete the days of your siege. As for you, take wheat, barley, beans, lentils, millet, and spelt, and put them in a single container, and make food from them for yourself. For in the same number of days that you lie on your side, 390 days, you will eat it. The food you will eat will be 8 ounces by day, a day by weight. You must eat it at fixed times. You must drink water by measure, a pint and a half. You must drink it at fixed times. And you must eat food like you would a barley cake. You must bake it in front of them over a fire made from dried human excrement. And the Lord said, this is how the people of Israel shall eat their unclean food among the nations where I will banish them. And I said, ah, sovereign Lord, I have never been ceremonially defiled before. I have never eaten a carcass of an animal torn by wild beasts. From my youth up, unclean meat has never entered my mouth. So he said to me, all right then, I will substitute cow manure instead of human excrement. You will cook your food over it. Then he said to me, Son of man, I am about to remove the bread supply in Jerusalem. They will eat their bread ration anxiously, and they will drink their water ration in terror, because they will lack bread and water. Each one will be terrified, and they will rot for their iniquity. And then chapter 5. As for you, son of man, take a sharp sword and use it as a barber's razor. Shave off some of the hair of your head and your beard. Then take scales and divide up the hair you cut off. Burn a third of it in a fire in the city. When the days of your siege are completed, take a third and slash it with a sword all around the city. Scatter a third to the wind, and I will unleash a sword behind them. But take a few strands of hair from those and tie them in the ends of your garment. Again, take some more of them and throw them into the fire and burn them up. For from there a fire will spread to all the house of Israel. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. This is Jerusalem. I placed her in the center of nations with countries all around her. Then she defiled my regulations and my statutes, becoming more wicked than the nations and the countries around her. Indeed, they have rejected my regulations and they do not follow my statutes. Therefore, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. Because you are more arrogant than the nations around you, you have not followed my statutes and not carried out my regulations. You have not even carried out the regulations of the nations around you. Therefore, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. I, even I, am against you, and I will execute judgment among you while the nations watch. I will do to you what I have never done before and will never do again because of all your abominable practices. Therefore, fathers will eat their sons within you, Jerusalem, and sons will eat their fathers. And I will execute judgments on you, and I will scatter any survivors to the winds. Therefore, as surely as I live, says the Sovereign Lord, because you defiled my sanctuary with all your detestable idols and with all your abominable practices, I will withdraw. My eye will not pity you, nor will I spare you. A third of your people shall die of the plague or be overcome by the famine within you. A third of your people will fall by the sword surrounding you, and a third I will scatter to the winds. I will unleash a sword behind them. Then my anger will be fully vented. I will exhaust my rage on them, and I will be appeased. Then they will know that I, the Lord, have spoken in my jealousy when I have fully vented my rage against them. I will make you desolate and an object of scorn of the nations around you in the sight of everyone who passes by. You will be an object of scorn and taunting, a prime example of destruction among the nations around you when I execute judgments against you in anger and raging fury. I, the Lord, have spoken. I will shoot against them deadly destructive arrows of famine, which I will shoot to destroy you. I will prolong a famine on you, and I will remove the bread supply. I will send famine and wild beasts against you, and they will take your children from you. Plague and bloodshed will overwhelm you, and I will bring a sword against you. I, the Lord, have spoken. I just realized I was reading from a different version. I thought it sounded a little different than the New King James. Let me switch back over. When you have too many versions on your tablet, sometimes you can get confused. What's the first thing you get out of this reading?
He's mad.
Yeah. Is Jerusalem in trouble? Could they be in any worse trouble? I don't think so. The reason I wanted to read those two chapters is you really have to keep it all in context, especially in these apocalyptic sections where there's a long description of what's going on and lots of detail, you know, like lay on your side for so many days and make your food and things. Sometimes you can go, okay, he's off into something else. But realize when we got to chapter 5, he said, okay, this is Jerusalem and this is why I'm doing it. You know, he lined it all up. Sometimes you have to read a few chapters to keep things in context. So, you remember the scroll that God gave Ezekiel to eat?
Outside was sweet, when he got inside it was bitter.
You know why it's bitter? Because this was a message. What was he supposed to do? What did God tell him to do? First thing he told him to do.
Go out and talk to some people.
Well, the first thing he told him to do was to take a tile, okay, and inscribe on it, or draw on it, a map of Jerusalem. And then he said, lay siege against it. In fact, he goes into quite a bit of detail. He says, post soldiers around it. Put battering rams at the doors. Build a ramp, a siege ramp against it. And lay siege against it. Now, a couple of interesting things about that. So what he's got here, now first of all, you say a tile. You know, today when we see a tile, we see these floor tiles are about this big. You know, the tiles in our houses are usually smaller. We have, you know, what was he doing? The tile that he was most likely using was a clay brick, which would have been around, somewhere around a foot by, 1 foot by 2 feet, somewhere around this big. Not too much different than these tiles. And then he's to inscribe on it. Whether the clay was wet or not, we don't know. Whether he was scratching it with a metal tool or drawing on it with charcoal, we don't know. But make a picture of Jerusalem and then go about acting out a siege against it. Now when he talks about a siege, it's an interesting historical bit. What does he say? Build a ramp against it? Have we heard that before? That was a common way of attacking a walled city back then. They literally would carry enough dirt up to the city wall that they would build a ramp that they could literally march over the wall into the city. If you wonder how they went about doing that, they did it the same way the Chinese built the Great Wall of China. You know how the Chinese built the Great Wall of China? They had 1 million people, and they said, hey you, grab that rock and head over there and throw it in that hole. Throw it in that pile. Hey you, grab a bucket of dirt and go do that. You get 1 million people doing that, you can build a pile pretty quick. Now granted, it took them decades to build the Great Wall of China, and 1 million people died in the process. But the point is, this is how they went about attacking a walled city or a fortress. There's one place called Masada today, which was a fortress that was in Israel. The Romans, when they took Masada, they built a siege ramp against it. The siege ramp is still there. It goes up several stories. That when they came to attack a city, they didn't just come and bang, bang, and the war was over in a day and it was done. It took years sometimes for them to bring down a fortified city. And this was common. So a siege ramp was one. The other one was battering rams. Since it said place battering rams, you know, historically this is the first time battering rams are mentioned anywhere. It's kind of an interesting little historical tidbit. But it's very realistic. It says, no, you're going to act this out. People are going to recognize that they're going to see the picture, they're going to know it's Jerusalem, and they're going to sit there and go, why are you acting out like some great army is going to come and attack Jerusalem? I mean, after all, isn't Jerusalem God's special place? Isn't his temple there? Hasn't he sworn to us by an everlasting covenant that his name would always be in Jerusalem and that David would always have someone on the throne? That's what the people were thinking. They said, we don't have to worry about obeying God, but God's made us these promises, and he's going to keep his promises. We don't have to keep ours, but he's going to keep his. This is kind of how they were thinking. Then what does he say to do? He says, I want you to take an iron plate and stick it in the ground between you and the city. What do you think that means? Take an iron plate. And remember, he's symbolizing, and he's going to be behind it. So he's going to be laying down here behind it. Separation for one. How about the ability of the city to fight off the enemy? If the enemy's sitting there behind an iron wall, you're not going to do it, are you? Now remember, when a city was under siege, it wasn't just sitting there cowering. They were fighting, you know, because they'd try to run at the gate. You've all seen these movies and stuff, right? They pour boiling oil on, throw rocks on them, shoot arrows at them. Sometimes the soldiers would come out and they'd fight, and then they'd come back in the city. That's the kind of thing that people did. So he's setting up a situation. He says, there's going to be a siege of Jerusalem. There's going to be a great army around it. And there's no way they're going to be able to defeat this army. And then he tells him something very strange. He says, I want you to lay down on your side. I want you to set your face against, behind the iron pan, I want you to set your face against Jerusalem. And I want you to lie down on your side for 390 days. One day for each year of the iniquity of the house of Israel. And then I want you to turn over on your other side and lay there for 40 days, one day for each year, the iniquity of the house of Judah. And while you're there, I'm going to tell you what you're going to eat. Verse 9. Take for yourself wheat, barley, beans, lentils, millet, and spelt. Spelt is a kind of wheat that doesn't let go of the chaff very well, so it's pretty coarse stuff. Put them in one vessel and make bread for them for yourself. During the number of days you lie on your side, 390 days, you shall eat it. And your food you shall eat shall be by weight, 20 shekels a day. There's roughly 20 shekels worth of food. Okay, now this is all red beans. Notice that this was a scattering of different kinds of food, a few different kinds of beans, a few different kinds of grains. It wasn't like go down to the market and get the beans because you want beans. It was like whatever is edible you have thrown together. And this little bit right here is all you got to eat every day. And then he says, take water. And you're going to drink water by measure 1/6 of a hen, which ends up being right close to 32 ounces. It's roughly about this much. And from time to time you'll drink it, and from time to time you're going to eat your food. And you're going to eat it as barley cakes, and you're going to bake it. For 390 days and for 40 days. By the way, what does that add up to? Mathematicians in the audience?
Bring a zero down from
430. Where have we seen that before? It's fascinating the way that God weaves the scripture together. 430, huh? Yeah. In the Old Testament and in the New, it refers to the time of the bondage of Israel in Egypt as 430 years. What's an interesting thing here is he's saying 390 years of the iniquity of Israel, 40 years of the iniquity of Judah, it adds up to 430 years. It's the same amount of time that they were in slavery in Egypt. But now they're talking about they're being slaves to sin, slaves to their idols. Just an interesting little tidbit. Now, lots of people want to argue that surely Ezekiel didn't lie on his side for 430 days, over a year. Surely he didn't do that. Now, why would people argue that?
Because they know they couldn't do it.
They couldn't do it? Well, it'd be very difficult, wouldn't it?
He couldn't take care of certain things that a human being has to do every day.
But aren't there people who are paralyzed that lie on their side for years and years and years? Even though they have to take care of business and everything else? Yeah, there sure is. There's a couple of things here. Some people, because there's so many visions in Ezekiel, they want to say, well, this is a vision, right? This is just a vision that he had. The problem with that, there's several problems with that. One of the problems is, how could he experience a vision of being on his side for over a year? If it was a vision and it was a brief vision, you know, like overnight or something like that or during the day, how could you experience the duration of time? Can you imagine? I mean, I have. Sometimes it just happens in one night. Have you ever been so tired at night that you just didn't roll over and you woke up in the same position you went to bed in and you feel like a truck hit you? You know, I know exactly what that feels like. And that's just one night. Have you ever known somebody who was paralyzed? Who had to stay in the same position all the time? One of the things they talk about is just the sheer misery of it.
You get bed sores too.
Yep, you get bed sores, your muscles can ache. Sometimes all you want to do is just stretch, but you can't.
And the human mind, we say, is not possible, but God said to do it, and He made it possible.
Well, and that's exactly the point, Gilbert, because if you notice what he says here, first of all, he says, I want you to do it, and here's why. And he says, and the days are important. It isn't just a big, long time. Right? He says 390 days, one day for each year, 40 days, one day for each year. And then he says, every day, this is what I want you to eat. And he gives them specific rules of what he can eat every day and what he can drink. And then he says, I will tie you up. Let's see, where does he actually say it? I want to find the place where he actually says it.
If he gets tired, I've read it so many times. He's going to eat.
Well, he can still eat.
Verse 8,
there it is. And surely I will restrain you so that you cannot turn from one side to another till you have ended the days of your siege.
But the thing about it is, there are certain daily functions that everybody has, and I have to do that.
Well, I'll ask you the question. How does a person who's paralyzed do it? They do it in place.
You should have someone taking care of him. I'm supposed to get to.
His wife, he was married and he had a wife. And, you know, you ask yourself, you know, how could he cook and how could he take care of, how could he, you know, go to the bathroom and other kinds of things. But there are people who were paralyzed who just
go back to
people have to care of.
If God said to do it, he made it possible for him to do it.
Yep. Now, would this be a very pleasurable existence?
No.
It'd be pretty miserable. Now, also remember what God said in the previous thing when he said, they're going to take you in your house. They're going to tie you up in your house. And I'm going to make your tongue cleave to the roof of your mouth. I'm going to make you unable to speak unless I tell you what to say. You will not be talking. This is going on, too, while he's lying on his side. So he can't talk. He's lying on his side. God has put him there. Now, he did this. He set this up. He goes out in the street in the middle of the camp and goes, and, you know, there goes Ezekiel. Man, I wonder what he's up to. And then he comes back with this tile. Why has he got a tile? What's he scratching on that tile? And what's he doing with that frying pan? And look, he laid down. What's going on? Ezekiel, what are you doing? Nothing, right? Silence. And then he's there. You don't think he's going to get up? You know, someone's asking, man, how's he going to go to the bathroom? You know? The next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. What do you think they're thinking? Remember, he's not talking to them. Yeah, he's crazy. That's what everybody's saying. He's crazy. This guy is crazy. Remember what God told him? I'm going to make your head so hard that you're going to be able to stand it. Don't worry what they're going to say to you. Don't worry about how they're going to look at you. They will know that a prophet has been among them. Then he gets to the cooking of it. And he says, not only am I going to give you this little bit of food. Now, you know, actually, you know, I hadn't done the analysis, but you could survive on this. It wouldn't be Gatorade, it would have just been water, but you could survive on this. Are you likely to gain weight?
No.
No. You likely to lose weight? Probably. Probably. And then God says, this is what you're going to eat. And he says, and you're going to cook it over human waste. Yeah. Now, in our culture, we don't think, you know, we think, well, that's pretty bad, but the cow dung doesn't sound much better. Because in our culture, we're kind of, I don't know, fidgety about that kind of stuff. You know, in the world, around the world, millions of people cook their food over cow dung on dried cow pies. It's normal. And it's not forbidden as being unclean. Because he turns around and he tells, you know, God says, you're going to cook it over human waste. And he says, oh, Lord, please no. Please no.
Except for the wealthy and what have you. I mean, those types of smells in the cities, in the neighborhoods and all were...
Yeah, there were plenty of smells.
They were always going on. They had baths and all that stuff.
Yeah, and actually, cow pies don't smell once they dry out. I grew up where there are plenty of cow pies. We used to play frisbee with them. They don't stink once they dry out. But God tells him that you're going to do this because the children of Israel are going to eat defiled bread.
What is it's all beyond human thought. Well, what really puzzles me is God says you're going to do it with the human waste. And he says, oh, I've never eaten anything unclean. And God said, okay, you can do it with this. God said, okay. God says you're going to do it. And then he changes his mind. But he already knew that he never had eaten anything that way.
That's true. That's an interesting question. But you know, there are several situations like that in the scripture where God says, this is what I'm going to do, and a righteous man, and it's a righteous man always, turns around and says, "Oh Lord, please not that." And God says, "Okay." What's the scripture saying, James? "The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much." King James. Does prayer matter? Does God listen? Yeah. Okay, so, and he says in verse 16 and 17, "Moreover, said, Son of man, surely I will cut off the supply of bread in Jerusalem. They shall eat bread by weight and with anxiety, and shall drink water by measure and with dread, that they may lack bread and water and be dismayed with one another and waste away because of their iniquity." So that's pretty bad. It gives worse. Chapter 5. So then he tells him, he says, "Take out a sharp sword and take it like a barber's razor and cut off your hair and your beard." Now it doesn't tell us how much hair he cut off. Okay? But he cut off enough to do what God wanted to do with it. He says, "Then take scales to weigh and divide the hair. You will burn with fire one third in the midst of the city." Now this is his little model city, so he's got him a fire burning in here now. He's put some coals in it. And it says, take, here's the hair. You got a third group of it here. So one third of it you put in the fire. One third of it you chop at with the sword, with the razor. You chop it up into bits. And one third you scatter to the wind. And then what does he say? "And I'm going to draw a sword out after them." But he says, "Take a few of the hairs and tuck them inside your garment." Now anybody who studied the Old Testament, especially like the book of Isaiah and others, what do you know God does? Even when he punishes his people, what is there always left over? A remnant. That's the remnant. And he's saying, a third are going to die by in the city and be consumed by the plague and the famine. A third are going to die by the sword. And almost the rest of them, they're going to be scattered everywhere with a sword chasing them. In other words, they're running for their lives, and a bunch of them are going to die. And then he said, "And the few that you keep out, the few that you keep out in your garment, even take some of those and throw them in the fire." Because this is going to be a really small number. You remember Jesus was one asked, "Lord, are there few that are going to be saved?" Remember? Same situation. So, now, verse 5, chapter 5, verse 5, God starts explaining why he's doing this. "Thus says the Lord God, this is Jerusalem. I have set her in the midst of nations and country. Around her she has rebelled against my judgments and doing more wickedness than the nations, and against my statutes more than the countries that are all around her." And he goes on and he talks about their disobedience. What's special about the disobedience and rebellion of Jerusalem versus, say, the Gentile nations?
Supposed to be the chosen.
They were God's chosen people, that's right. And in fact, he says later, he says, none of the nations around you ever changed their gods. He said, they worship pagan gods. They worship idols that aren't even gods. And they're loyal to them. And yet, what have you done to me? After all I've done for you, after being my chosen people, after me putting my name in your midst, which is what he said the temple was all about, right? It was a place for my name. And all the blessings and all the protection. And what have you done to me? He's saying, this is why this is going to happen to you. Now, one of the things we're going to see in the book of Isaiah, and we're right into it now, is the book of Isaiah is written, Ezekiel. The book of Ezekiel is written to the people of Israel. It's written to the people of Jerusalem and Judah and the people who are already captives. Yeah. But in the context of Ezekiel's message, God is going to be explaining to Ezekiel and through Ezekiel to the people why he is going to do what he's going to do. Why is the justification for all of this? What's he going to do? What's going to happen to Jerusalem? If any of this comes true, what's happening to Jerusalem?
Destroyed.
Yeah, it's going to be destroyed. Now, remember the timeline. Where are we at? Ezekiel's in Babylon. Daniel and his friends have already been taken. Were taken 9 years before him, so they're in Babylon. But they're still, the nation of Israel, still, the nation of Judah still exists, and Jerusalem still exists, and the temple still exists. What's going to happen in just a few years from now, from this point?
An army going while we're on them.
Mm-hmm. Nebuchadnezzar's going to come in, he's going to destroy it. He's going to destroy the temple, burn the gates, tear down the walls, make it a heap of rubble. Do you remember how Ezra and Nehemiah describe it when they come back? It's a heap of rubble. When they start building the wall by piling up the rubble, the guys around them, their enemies around them, are laughing and said, "Man, a fox could jump over that." That's how bad it was. That's how bad it was destroyed. What God is going to do throughout the book of Ezekiel, especially the first 2/3 of it, is he's going to say, this is why I have to destroy Jerusalem. This is why I have to come in judgment upon these people. Because of the wickedness and rebellion that they've shown me for years and years and generations. This is why I've got to do it. What we're going to see, and this is a really, really big picture thought, because remember, we're going to study all the way through Revelation eventually. You're going to see Ezekiel is talking primarily to Judah and Jerusalem about God's judgment on them. Daniel's going to talk about the history of the Jewish nation and God's judgment on the Jewish nation, culminating in the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And in Revelation, and the same way, he says, look what they're doing, look what they're doing. Right? This is in the same way in the book of Revelation, God's going to say, this is why I've got to judge the whole world. This is why I have to visit judgment on people. Isn't that amazing that God cares enough about us to explain his actions and to justify his actions to us? Little specks of dirt he created. Isn't that amazing? He doesn't have to. There's no place that says God has to explain his actions at all. But he does. Okay. Yeah.
He's our Father.
Yeah. And our Creator. And he loves us. And he wants us to follow him. That's why he spends all this time. Now, verse 8. Therefore, thus says the Lord, indeed I, even I, am against you, and I will execute judgments in your midst in the sight of the nations. I will do among you what I have never done, and the like of which I will never do again, because of all your abominations. Therefore, fathers shall eat their sons in your midst, and sons shall eat their fathers. And I will execute judgments among you, and all you who remain I will scatter to the winds. Here he's saying very similar things.
You think that's literal or just...
That's a really good segue. Let's turn to 2 Kings...
Destruction of them.
You're right on it. 2 Kings 6. Now first of all, he's talking about this happening in Jerusalem. You remember what happened every time a major army came to try to attack and conquer Jerusalem? Like, say, the Rabshakeh, the general, the king of Assyria. Remember in Isaiah, he comes and has 185,000 soldiers, and they get around Jerusalem, and he says, "I'm going to take you out. You know, God sent me to take you out. I'm going to take you out." And you know, Hezekiah goes to Isaiah and says, "What should I do?" And he just says, "You just wait a minute." That night, one angel knocks off 185,000 Assyrian soldiers. The next morning, they're all dead. God has providentially protected Jerusalem from the disaster that he's going to allow to happen here. But let's read this in 2 Kings. This is actually talking about Samaria, okay, which is was the capital city of the nation of Israel, not Judah, right? The northern kingdom, which was wicked, had left God and followed after idols. Let's just read about this a minute. And it happened after this that Ben-Hadad, king of Assyria, gathered his army and went up and besieged Samaria. And there was a great famine in Samaria, and indeed they besieged it until a donkey's head was sold for 80 shekels of silver and 1/4 of a cab of dove droppings for 5 shekels of silver. Then as the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, a woman cried out to him, saying, "Help me, my lord, O king." And he said, if the Lord does not help you, where can I find help from you? From the threshing floor or from the wine press? Then the king said to her, what is troubling you? And she answered, this woman said to me, give your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow. So we boiled my son and ate him. And I said to her on the next day, give your son that we may eat him. But she had hidden her son. Now it happened when the king heard the words of the woman, he tore his clothes. And as he passed by on the wall and people looked, and underneath he had sackcloth on his body. That's a real account, folks. Kings is a history. Yes. Yes, they did.
God had told people through the prophets it was going to be far worse than they had ever imagined.
Yep.
Well, there was no food. I mean, the army wasn't throwing food over the wall
right.
to the enemy.
Right.
And they're in there for years, and they had no food to eat.
Yeah.
So they either eat each other or they come out, one or the other.
Yeah. And it's difficult to talk about this because it's so horrific and distasteful, right? It's called cannibalism. But it's real. And notice, he isn't saying, oh yeah, a few people had died and they decided to eat them. It said fathers are going to eat their sons and sons are going to eat their fathers. In other places where it describes this kind of a situation, it says a mother will take her child and eat it. I mean, can you imagine the horror of that situation? Could you imagine anything worse? This is the kind of thing. You know, we've talked a lot about hyperbole, right? Because in places it says, you know, okay, like Isaiah, it says, I'm going to turn, you know, the whole area of Babylon into Edom, into burning fire and pitch. And then it says, and oh, by the way, the porcupine's going to live there. So we know he's not saying it's a lake of fire for eternity because porcupines couldn't live there. But this is not hyperbole. This is real. This is the kind of situation they're in. But when God says, I'm going to turn your world upside down, it's going to be so bad, it's never been this bad, and it'll never be this bad again, for those people, is that absolutely true? Yeah. It's as worse as it could possibly be. Okay. Man. 11, verse 11, chapter 5. Therefore, as I live, says the Lord God, surely, because you have defiled my sanctuary with all your detestable things and with all your abominations, therefore I will diminish you. My eye will not spare, nor will I have pity. One third of you shall die of the pestilence and be consumed with famine in your midst. One third shall fall by the sword all around you, and I will gather another third, scatter another third to all the winds, and I will draw a sword after them. Because you have defiled my sanctuary with your detestable things and with all your abominations. What's the sanctuary God's talking about? What is a sanctuary? What's that mean?
That's his temple, right?
Well, it's more than just his temple. Sanctuary means a holy place. Okay? So when he talks about his sanctuary, he's talking about his holy place. Well, the temple had several areas. It had a place called the Holy Place, and it had a place called the Holiest, or Holiest of Holies, right? The Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant was, for instance, and where they had to, once a year, bring the blood for atonement for all the people. How did they defile the sanctuary with all their detestable things, all your abominations?
They probably put some sort of idol in there.
That's exactly what they did. And in fact, you can read about that in Kings and Chronicles, where it talks about the wicked kings like Manasseh, for instance. It said that they actually went into the temple and set up idols. Now, we're going to hear a lot of the religious state of Jerusalem in the next several chapters. Because God is going to take Ezekiel in a vision and go show him time and time and time again what the people are doing. So we're going to get a real clear picture of what the situation is. But God said, he said, you have so defiled my sanctuary that this is what I'm going to do to you. And a little later we're going to hear Ezekiel say, I saw the glory of God depart from the temple. He says, I'm going to abandon my temple and I'm going to abandon Jerusalem. It's going to be destroyed. And it was. Okay. Last bit. Verse 13. And thus my anger shall be spent, and I will cause my fury to rest upon them, and I will be avenged. And they shall know that I, the Lord, have spoken it in my zeal, when I have spent my fury upon them. Moreover, I will make you a waste and a reproach among the nations that are all around you, in the sight of all who pass by. So it shall be a reproach, a taunt, a lesson, and an astonishment to the nations that are all around you, when I execute judgments among you in anger and in fury and in furious rebukes. I, the Lord, have spoken. When I send against them the terrible arrows of famine, which will be for destruction, which I shall send to destroy you, I will increase the famine upon you and cut off your supply of bread. So I will send against you famine and wild beasts, and they will bereave you. Pestilence and blood shall pass through you, and I will bring the sword against you. I, the Lord, have spoken. Why does he keep saying that? Why does he keep saying, I, the Lord, have spoken?
He's the one doing it. He wants to make sure they know.
He wants to make sure they know it. Remember what he told Ezekiel? What did he tell Ezekiel? They will know that a prophet has been among them. Is God going to make it such that the people go, well, you know, if it weren't for that mean old King Nebuchadnezzar, we'd still be doing great down here. Right? There's not going to be any excuse. So people are going to know precisely why all this calamity and disaster is coming upon them. Do we know that? Think about that for a second from a New Testament standpoint. Are people going to know when we stand before the throne in judgment why they're there and why they're going where they're going? Yeah. So, also, you remember there are a couple of times Moses did this. God said, get out of the way, Moses. I'm going to wipe these people out and I'm going to start over with you. Remember? What was Moses' argument when he said, God, please don't do that? Well, that was Abraham talking about the destruction of the city. But that's one argument that was made. When Moses did it, he said, the nations around will say, God brought him out, but he couldn't take care of him, so he destroyed him in the desert. That was Moses' argument. He said, God, I don't want to bring reproach on your name by having you destroy these people. He did it because he was seeking God's glory. But here God is saying, I'm going to do it. Now, how many years has that been since Moses' time? On the order of 1,000?
1440 to 590, 400, 800.
800 years? 800 years God's been putting up with this. And he finally says, that's it, that's enough. And the people around are going to know the why I did it. Because of their sin. Okay, we'll stop there.